Oye, oye, oye. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-3016, United States of America versus Nelson Brockenborough, appellant. Mr. Gilbert for the appellant, Ms. Pan for the appellee.
Good morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Richard Gilbert, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Nelson Brockenborough, on appeal. I was not the trial counsel for Mr. Brockenborough. I'd like, if the court's questions permit, to save 5 minutes for rebuttal. 15 minutes is not a lot of time, and there's a lot of issues, so I initially stand ready to answer questions about issues that the court thinks may be helped by further argument. But basically, this is not a case. It is a very fact-driven case. In fact, I didn't cite any cases at all in my reply brief because basically the government and I agree on the general principles. But it's an unusual factual case, and consequently, existing precedent is less helpful to the court in terms of the specific facts involved.
Well, to focus you then, what do you think is your strongest trial error argument? Ignore sentencing for the moment.
All right. I think the strongest one has to do with the multiple conspiracies, actually.
Well, we have cases like Graham that say that, you know, where parties are acting together and they're interdependent, that's enough. That's a single conspiracy. Now, most of those come up in the drug conspiracy context, and this is different in that sense. But I know the indictment is framed to emphasize the fraudulent deed, but it's also broad enough to encompass the fraud in obtaining the property.
Well, let me be clear about, although I would certainly love it if the court would agree with me about the sufficiency of the evidence, but that particular issue is not directed at sufficiency. Rather, your case law says that if there's any evidence that would support it, the defense is entitled to that instruction. And clearly the fact that there is no evidence whatsoever that Mr. Brockenborough had anything to do with the fraudulent deed. There is no evidence that Mr. Brockenborough had anything to do with the fraudulent tax assessment.
Okay. So the jury found him not guilty on the fraudulent deed.
At least the forgery aspects of that, yes.
That's right. And your argument is that there's a risk that the jury therefore may have convicted him of the broader conspiracy because it thought it couldn't separate the two conspiracies?
Yes, as a trial lawyer trying to litigate these cases, the problem becomes conspiracy is a very complex issue, and jurors do not understand it easily, and I'm sure that any trial practitioner standing before you would acknowledge that. If we get that instruction, I didn't do the trial, but this is why I think Mr. Rosen wanted it. This is what I would do with it had I been the trial lawyer. If you get the separate conspiracies instruction, admittedly allows the jury, to make that finding, then it clarifies the argument. Because the problem is you just have this one co-conspirator's liability instruction that talks in terms of one conspiracy. There was clearly fraudulent conduct on the part of Denise McLeod, clearly on two distinct occasions. And so Brockenborough signs the contract, and that's what the wire fraud count was the sending of the contract ultimately to purchase the property for $165,000. And so the jury may well have concluded, well, it's one conspiracy. McLeod was clearly engaged in fraud. Brockenborough clearly signed the contract based on this co-conspirator's liability without separating the issue that Brockenborough himself had to have some fraudulent intent.
What's the best case to support this argument?
I don't know that I could give you a best case.
Well,
because
if you were the judge trying to write the opinion on that theory, I'm just trying to understand it. In other words, the jury clearly made a distinction in its verdict. Counsel was able to argue this to the jury, even though he didn't have the instruction. And so what is the principle of the law that we would adopt?
Well, because the instruction, that's why the defense is entitled to an instruction on theory of defense, because that gives the trial advocate, when he's arguing to the jury, the reinforcement of having the judge give instructions that he can rely on in his argument.
I know, but, you know, the Supreme Court has said to us, you know, we do look at harmless error here. And that's, how do we get over that? That's what I'm not clear about in your argument.
Well, I mean, part of what makes this case interesting for me to have wrestled through it is because the issues are interrelated. You know, the question of whether he was a marshal is interrelated with sentencing. It's interrelated to the fraud. It's related to the, I mean, these issues all dovetail together. My argument as to the sufficiency was, look, he had nothing to do with the fraudulent deed. He had nothing to do with the fraudulent assessment. He had nothing to do with the decision not to tell Katrina Robinson when they were negotiating.
Counsel, you keep repeating that he had nothing to do with the deed. He knew that McLeod, or how, I'm not certain how you pronounce your name, McLeod, had obtained the deed, right? And he cut a check for her that would create an inference, at least a reasonable inference, that the deed was being purchased for quite much less than the value. And all we need to find here, right, is that a rational jury could make that determination. We don't need to find that that's the best argument. But isn't that his connection to the deed? He didn't forge the deed himself. Therefore, perhaps that's the reason he's acquitted on the D.C. charges. But on the conspiracy, there is evidence that he was involved with the deed.
Well, there's a couple of problems with that. And I don't know that Mr. Rosen elucidated in the way, again, that I would add up in the trial counsel. First of all, there is an assumption running through this that Denise McLeod actually paid anybody $10,000. All right, there's no evidence that she actually did. There's no reason, of course, for her to have paid anybody.
But he cut a check for her.
Right, but he says, I don't see the deed until the time we're removing the deed.
He knows there's a deed, right? I mean, the trial court's theory, as I understand it, was that he knew there was this deed. He cut a check in connection with the deed, and the fact that the check was so small in amount could be used to create the inference that he knew foul play was at work here.
Well,
isn't that the theory? And again, all we need to determine is that a rational jury could.
I certainly agree that was the theory that the government proceeded on. I agree with that.
That's not irrational. It may not be the best explanation of facts, but that's not what we're looking at. Yeah, mm-hmm. But that's not what we need to find, right? We just need to find that it's rational, that it's not crazy.
Well, but there's, first of all, let me say, there's no evidence, first of all, that he saw the deed before. Well, but he's cutting the check.
Suppose he didn't. Suppose he never saw the deed. He would not have had to see the deed to be a conspirator, would he?
No, but he'd have to know what she had done in order to make him part of a fraudulent conspiracy.
I say that there are cases about the right of a defendant to a multiple conspiracy instruction, but there are also cases that say we shouldn't just break a conspiracy into pieces in order to warrant that instruction. And aren't you trying to break this one into rather fine pieces? The object of the conspiracy, as alleged, was to fraudulently obtain that real estate. That there might be different ways involved in doing it does not convert that into multiple conspiracies, does it?
Well, Your Honor, you know, to paraphrase an expression, if he says, well, I want to obtain the property by hook but not by crook, you know, the fact is that he clearly engaged in a negotiation to purchase the property. And if you want to talk about the COSI conversation, which is our view, the strongest argument, although not sufficient in our view, if you want to talk about that, that's fine. But there's all this other stuff that is clearly, unequivocally fraudulent that he has no part of. And so, no, this is not, I don't think I'm breaking this into two fine pieces at all. I think these are very distinct chunks. A jury might have found that it was all one conspiracy. Remember, that's not my argument as to the multiple conspiracy that the court, as a matter of law, had to find there were. I mean, I agree it's a jury question. But, boy, you have a really extreme course of conduct here with absolutely trying to steal this property by forging a dead person's signature that he apparently has no involvement with. Then you have this fraudulent tax assessment.
Can you explain the check to which Judge Griffith referred?
Well, I was trying to say that. One of the issues that gets glossed over here is again, this assumption that she somehow paid somebody $10,000.
To move across that, how did you explain that check that Judge Griffith was referring to?
I would.
Check
this is how I would explain it. Denise McLeod is trying to cheat Brockenborough as well as the Roy heirs. She files a deed that claims she paid $10,000. There is no evidence that she did and no reason why she would have. So she doesn't show Brockenborough the deed, but Brockenborough may see it at some point. So to cover herself, she tells Brockenborough, this is half of my expenses. All right, if you looked at the deed, it would be half of her expenses. If you believe that, in fact, she never paid anybody $10,000, she's making an extra $5,000 from Brockenborough. And the other issue about that, I see my time's about it, let me just point out that what the face value of the deed is not necessarily the purchase price. I mean, that's why they have this whole procedure at the Recorder of Deeds. You can come in and say, I sold it, you know, or I bought it for $10,000, I bought it for $1, I bought it for $100,000. They're going to look at the value of the property in order to assess the taxes on, because people do that. People come in and say, oh, I only paid $1 for this. And so there's no reason that $10,000 figure would necessarily have said, oh, this is the final price, and somehow she got this.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government.
May it please the court, Florence Pan on behalf of the United States. Addressing the multiple conspiracy issue, which was addressed by Mr. Gilbert, the evidence at trial proved the conspiracy that was alleged in the indictment, which was a single conspiracy, the object of which was to obtain real property for little or no value. This court's case law clearly says that the object of a conspiracy should not be defined by too narrow or specific terms. The single conspiracy charged in the indictment was the conspiracy that was proved at trial. Now, appellant is saying that there are a number of different conspiracies, and he's defining them by, for example, a conspiracy to forge a deed, or a conspiracy to hide that forgery, or a conspiracy to submit a false tax assessment. Now, that is cutting too finely what the goal of this conspiracy was. These are means to achieve the object.
The indictment seems to do that itself, but that's neither here nor there, I suppose.
Well, I dispute that, Judge Rogers. The indictment charges a single conspiracy with
the
object.
I know, but the whole first part is just talking about the fraudulent deed.
But those are manners and means to achieve the conspiracy and overt acts in support of the conspiracy.
And so the concession during sentencing doesn't help the defendant here.
I'm sorry, what is the concession, Your Honor?
That it was completely separate.
Your Honor, I'm going to dispute that it is. It is a separate, there were definitely two parts of this scheme. One was to obtain the property by means of the fraudulent deed, and there was a second part which was through negotiations, and there are therefore two distinct parts of the manner and means. But it was a single conspiracy to obtain the property illegally. And I would like to focus also on the issue of prejudice. Appellant has not made any argument about how he was prejudiced by the failure to give a multiple conspiracy instruction.
Well, he did it in his briefs, too.
Your Honor,
if the jury thought it.
Well, he is not, because prejudice is defined by spillover prejudice.
That's his spillover argument.
Correct, Your Honor, but appellant was charged with the forged deed. Therefore, the evidence was properly before the jury whether or not that multiple conspiracy instruction was given. So I guess what I'm trying to argue is that appellant has not focused on prejudice and how he was prejudiced by this evidence, which was properly before the jury anyway. He was not entitled.
Let me just be clear. I don't understand his argument that the evidence wasn't properly before the jury. He's simply saying that had there been a jury instruction saying that there were at least two conspiracies here,
yes,
then when the jury was deliberating, it could have said, well, he's just not guilty of what I'll call the first conspiracy. Now we have to separately consider, as opposed to the jury just saying, well, we're going to sort of cut the baby in half.
But Your Honor, he would have had to have shown that he would have been prejudiced on the conspiracy that he was convicted of, which was the charged conspiracy. And he's not even addressing the negotiation part of this. And he is saying that
I thought, just let me be clear, because maybe I've misunderstood his argument. Mm-hmm. I thought he was saying that there is this spillover prejudice because the jury was under the impression it was just a single conspiracy, so it necessarily had to convict him because there was all this other evidence.
Well, two points on that, yeah. Judge Rogers. I think what he's saying is that there were two conspiracies, one for the forged deed, one for the negotiations, and this conspiracy about the forged deed was not properly attributable to him, and there was spillover prejudice from the evidence from the forged deed spilling onto here. Well, he was charged with the forged deed. Therefore, the evidence from the forged deed was properly admitted against him, so there's no improper spillover prejudice with respect to what he was actually convicted for, even assuming that there were multiple conspiracies, which there were not.
So back to my point about what would be the principle that we would be adopting to accept his argument, since it doesn't fall within the line of spillover cases.
Correct. And I think my argument is that there isn't an argument here about real prejudice. And another point on that is, even if we were to consider the forged deed and the negotiations separately, he was, in fact, acquitted of the forged deed. So even if there were spillover prejudice, it does appear that the jury might have discounted that evidence against him. So that's another factor to be considered in terms of prejudice. I'd like to address briefly the significance of the check, because that's another thing that Mr. Gilbert argued. The check that appellant cut to Denise McLeod was for a very specific sum of money, $8,804.
All checks are for a specific sum of money.
Yes, but this specific sum of money has significance, Judge Santel, in that that was exactly half the price that Denise McLeod would have purportedly paid for this property. She paid, on the forged deed, $10,000 plus $7,600 of taxes and fees. So exactly half that amount is the check that appellant cut.
Isn't that consistent, though, with the appellant's theory that she was defrauding him? Who did she pay $10,000 to in reality? I know she had it recited that she paid
$10,000. She may not have paid $10,000 to anyone, but this check says, for my half of 1133 6th Street Northwest, and that is compelling evidence of appellant's knowledge of the fraud, because how could he have legitimately thought that he could pay $8,804 for half interest in a house in a booming neighborhood which is near the convention center?
And then have continued to engage in other activity to try to get the same house thereafter.
Absolutely. We would not rely only on the check either, Judge Griffith. Mm-hmm. We would also rely on all the other evidence which shows his guilt, including that he was hand in glove with Denise McLeod throughout this transaction. April 2005, he is with her at the property, scoping it out. June 21st, she is calling the lawyer to the estate, David Skull, and saying, U.S. Marshal Brockenborough wants to buy this property, okay? Thereafter, she's telling Todd Zirkle. Todd Zirkle says, who should I make an offer to if I want to buy this property? Denise McLeod says, to me and to Nelson Brockenborough. At the COSI 1 meeting on October 19th, appellant is actively making statements about this property and trying to drive down the price and induce Katrina Robinson to sell this property right away. He tells her, this is a very serious problem. It's like spinning a roulette wheel the longer you hold on to this property.
Let me ask you, when do you think is the earliest evidence of a conspiracy here? I mean, the district court rejected the idea of an April 2005 conspiracy, but was her ruling, was she looking at a lawful conspiracy or an unlawful conspiracy?
She was looking only at an unlawful conspiracy, and she explicitly said
so. So what's the earliest evidence of a lawful conspiracy?
I think she said that as of April 20, 2005, there was overwhelming evidence of a business relationship.
Okay.
So she acknowledged that there was a relationship as of 2005, and her finding was only that there wasn't necessarily evidence of a criminal conspiracy as of April 2005.
But let me ask you a question about the sentencing. Let me give you a hypothetical. If we have someone on the stand and they're asked, and this is the obstruction of justice issue, and someone on the stand is asked whether they ran the red light, okay, and they say, no, I didn't. I didn't run the red light. And then later in their testimony, they decide, you know, that wasn't true. I need to come clean about that. So 10 minutes later, they interrupt the direct examination or cross-examination and say, you know, I told you a couple of minutes ago that I didn't run the red light. Well, actually, I did run the red light. Is that obstruction of justice? Is that set of circumstances? Have they obstructed justice there? Is any lie told under oath?
I don't think so, because in the hypothetical that you posited, there was no willful intent to mislead the court, and there was a voluntary
correction. Oh, no, there was. No, it's me. I willfully intended to mislead the court. I later corrected it, but at that point in time, I did. Isn't that obstruction of justice?
Your Honor, it may or may not be, but in this case, we're on plain error review. An appellant never objected to the court's finding.
We have an opinion in In Re Seal case saying that by analogy to Rule 52, that when this court is reviewing the district court's factual findings in connection with sentencing, our standard of review is clear error, that there's no preservation requirement, so that it's not plain error, even though the defendant didn't object in the district court.
I am not aware of such a precedent, Judge Rogers. I apologize.
All right. It's an opinion by Judge Edwards, joined by Judge Silberman.
Before the court, there is no dispute with respect to the standard of review. Appellant's reply brief does not dispute the standard of review with respect
to
the
instruction. Well, we're bound by our own precedent. In any event, yes. You would argue, I assume, that there was no clear error, and let me hear that argument, if I may.
Your Honor, if I may frame the issue for the court. The court, for obstruction of justice, the district court, made three different findings of falsehoods that the defendant made in his testimony. And the court need only find that one of those was not erroneous in order to uphold the obstruction finding. And there are more straightforward findings that the court could look at. And I would like to address those as well. But in response to the court's question, I would say that in this case, under the particular factual circumstances, the court's finding was not clearly erroneous because under the facts I'm trying to address your question about the statement about the sexual relationship.
All right.
Appellant is asserting that on direct examination, I omitted or I lied, but in cross-examination, I came clean, and that doesn't support obstruction. And we would submit that on the facts of this particular case, the court did not clearly err in finding a willful intent to lie because there was a whole litigation of this issue, which appellant was present for. The government filed a motion in limine to bring out the sexual relationship because it was so relevant in this case to prove knowledge and to rebut the defendant's
intent. But I don't think you can call obstruction of justice when a defendant has an argument to oppose the admission of evidence. That's not obstruction.
No, I'm not saying that that's obstruction. I'm saying that when he therefore omitted it at trial, he knew it was material and therefore was willful when he omitted it.
He wasn't asked on direct examination, tell me everything about your relationship with this Mrs. McLeod.
He was asked a very open-ended question to characterize his relationship about Ms. McLeod. He knew that this was material and important, and the court had ruled on it, and he nevertheless omitted
it. The question is, what is your relationship? What is the meaning of is? You know, I mean, the sexual relationship was over before the conspiracy started. Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about obstruction of justice here, and I just wonder if that's the type
If
of...
If I may.
Yes, go ahead.
The question on direct examination was, I want you to tell the court and the jury and the prosecutor basically your relationship with Ms. Denise McLeod.
Right.
Appellant omits. On cross-examination, the prosecutor says, now, Mr. Rosen asked you on direct examination this morning what your relationship was with Ms. McLeod. Did you get a chance to finish that answer?
Mm-hmm.
And the appellant says, I think I finished it.
Mm-hmm.
And thereafter, she impeached
The question him. Is your basic relationship.
That's right. For instance, I would say, if you asked me what is my relationship with the chief judge, I would say we're colleagues, or I'd on the court. But I might not also tell you that, well, we met each other, 20 years ago at a conference or something like that.
Well, I would say in this transcript, he went on to talk about this relationship at length. But even if the court doesn't believe that this supports the obstruction enhancement, there are two other findings which clearly do. And I would direct the court's attention.
Now, let me ask you one basic question about that.
Mm-hmm.
If the judge enhanced based on three obstructions, is it automatic that the enhancement would be the same had she only found two of the obstructions?
Well, our suggestion is that on plain error review, clearly, yes.
I'm not sure why that's clear. Anytime a lawyer says clearly, I start
I apologize,
rarely,
Your Honor.
Clear,
under the plain error standard, which we believe is applicable and which appellant does not dispute is applicable for the obstruction enhancement, he would have to show that the error was plain, clear, or obvious.
He has shown it as to one of the three.
He would also
automatically not entitle him to relief? Is it automatic that the judge would have imposed the same enhancement based on the two rather than on the three?
And we think yes, because under plain error review, he would actually
I'm
also
sure
have to show
why the standard of review has anything to do with the question I'm asking you now,
Your Honor, because he would have to show a miscarriage of justice, and if it is upheld on one of the other two, there's no miscarriage of justice in applying the obstruction enhancement. Okay,
well,
and so it's his burden.
Ten, and he was able to establish error as to nine of them. You would say we then couldn't send it back for to say, well, you've only got one obstruction. Does that still warrant the same enhancement?
We would submit that the court would not need to do that because he would not have met his burden to show a miscarriage of justice. He has to show error that affects the fairness, integrity, and public reputation of the judicial proceedings under plain error review. And given that the other two enhancements are amply supported by the record, even if the court...
That's not the same as saying the other two enhancements would have resulted in the same sentence. We seem to be passing in the night here.
I'm sorry, Judge Sandel. I think that the question before the court is not whether it would have been the same sentence. The question is whether the sentence he got is a miscarriage of justice. And it would not be if that obstruction is supported.
But even in an older... The case I'm referring to, the Seal case, is 552 Fed 3rd at 849. Mm-hmm. But even in an earlier opinion, United States versus Saro, S-A-R-O, mm-hmm. this court took the position that even if you view the standard of review as plain error, it's a strict standard when you're talking about sentencing because we want to be sure that the district court got it right since we're talking about a defendant's liberty. So back to Judge Santel's question.
Yes.
I mean, unless the judge, I know the judge here said, look, I found these three things and there are a lot more things I could find as well.
Yes.
But she never said on any one of these I would go ahead and enhance for obstruction of justice.
That is true, Judge Rogers, and I'm aware of Sarah, and I think that is true. But we would submit that her finding of obstruction was amply supported on all three grounds. And if the court finds that there's a problem with the first one, I don't think it's clear error. And appellant never objected to her finding on that ground. And certainly the other two are amply supported.
And those two are?
The other two grounds were she found that he lied about his eviction of tenants, and she used eviction not in the technical sense. He lied in his direct testimony and said that he did not do that. And she said, you certainly did. And she also found that he lied about threatening Katrina Robinson that he would withdraw the protection of the police if she didn't sell the property to him. And I can direct the court to the relevant transcript sites for those two.
I've got those.
That's not your problem at this point.
No, yeah.
You're answering a question very well, but it's not the one we have.
Lied about eviction of tenants. I mean, the marshal didn't evict the tenants.
If I may, he didn't technically evict them in the legal sense, but he removed the tenants from the property. And during the trial...
He didn't even do that.
Well, if I may, Your Honor, he didn't physically do it, but he engineered it. And in the taped conversation at COSI 1, he took credit for it. He said, I did it. They said I couldn't do it, but I did it. Now, at trial, he said, I didn't do it. I had nothing to do with it. And so that was the lie that the trial court found. And I can direct the court to the transcript sites. In the 1025 trial at page 178, the prosecutor asked, you said... Now, you were doing this. You were putting these people out. Isn't that right? I was doing this. I was putting these people out. That's on the tape. And he says, I was not putting anybody out. The appropriate agencies were called to get these people out. However, on the tape, he says at page 7, well, I tell you, the neighbors were so happy that we had gotten them out. They told me that I couldn't do it. And again, page 8, police said I couldn't do it. They said they're not an eviction crew. But what I used was the fact that there were two fires in the house, and that's how we finally got them out. So that's the lie on the eviction.
All right, okay. So when the landlord says, I finally got these tenants evicted, I mean, he got them evicted by judicial process, but he didn't actually do the eviction.
I guess that's
the distinction I'm trying to draw here.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that is a distinction that appellant tries to make. Now, the term eviction was used at trial, not just to mean the technical eviction with a court ordered. In fact, I don't think there was a technical eviction with a court order ever. There was a removal of the tenants from the property. And the language that is used in the transcript is putting people out, and he denies putting people out, but then on the tape, he admits putting people out. The third lie related to...
He says we had finally gotten the tenants out.
Yes. The police said that I couldn't do it, but I did it. Okay?
We... That's what's on the tape.
He says we, but he also says I at various points on the tape. And the trial court was in the best position to assess this, Judge Rogers, because there was a lot of transcript on this. I'm just trying to give you the most pertinent parts.
But I understand,
there was considerable testimony.
What the district court said. as to her findings, that's all.
Yes, yes.
Okay. And then about the threat.
That's
the third one.
The threat, I think, is the most straightforward of the three. At trial, page October 25th transcript, pages 187 to 188. Question, you meant to suggest to Ms. Robinson that if you pulled out of the deal, you said, you know how the police are, meaning they will go away, right? Answer, I didn't mean that they would go away just because I was out of the deal. On the tape, transcript, pages 101 to 102, the defendant says, talking about what the police had said to them, you know, you're still in the mix, right? Meaning appellant is still in the mix. And I said, yeah, because please, I appreciate it. Meaning the police are taking care of this property because he's in the mix. Now we're going to do this for you. We're going to do this for appellant. They'll help if I don't do my part and get this thing sewed up. They're not gonna. They're gonna stop. Okay? They're gonna say, well, hey, it's like anything else. So appellant is saying, if I don't get this thing sewed up, they're gonna stop. They're gonna stop protecting you. And I think this is the most straightforward of the three grounds.
Mm-hmm. Unless my colleagues have further questions, your time is up. How much time does appellant have left? Okay, we'll hear you in rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you. I'd ask the court to affirm the judgment of the district court.
I would like to talk about sentencing, I guess, in these minutes since that came up. First of all, I don't believe that I conceded plain error. I believe that when I was talking about the legal standard at my brief at page 35, I cited the court's opinion in Day, which talks about legal questions are reviewed de novo, factual errors are to be affirmed unless clearly erroneous, and due deference to the court's application of the guidelines to facts. I mean, that was the standard that I raised.
Well, counsel for the government's argument is if we look at the tape and then compare the transcript at trial, client was clearly lying.
It is the testimony at trial that forms or should form the basis for the obstruction of justice. We know for a fact, as much as we can, that Nelson Brockenborough did not evict those tenants. It was not an eviction. They were removed by public safety officials, fire and police, because of appropriate and lawful grounds to remove them. Now, if he's puffing.
Let me ask you about your premise there. Suppose a defendant on the tape says, I threw these people out. All right, and the government has that. And then at trial, he says, I didn't throw these people out. Obstruction of justice?
Well, the question is, did he? I mean, as a factual matter, did he? Because if he didn't, then he's not lying at trial. Even if he's puffing to Katrina Robinson about, you know, well, I was able to arrange this. And indeed, he may well have arranged it in the sense of contacting. We don't know who contacted the police first. We know there were other people interested as well. But if he contacts them as a retired police officer and gets them to come and look at that property. Remember, she's saying he lied about using his authority as a U.S. Marshal, and there is no evidence that he said that he was a United States Marshal to anybody on that day. With respect to the threat, you know, the question is whether he threatened Katrina Robinson. The risks that he discusses about the property being vacant are true, real risks. Fire and abandoned buildings for all of the reasons. Accident, deliberate, crack, whatever. The risks were real. If there's no insurance, the risks to the estates are real. The liability of the owner if they permit people to go into that building, and it is the owner's responsibility, not the police. Those are all real risks. And he is saying that, look, because of my connection, this goes to the abuse of trust, because I'm a retired police officer, because I trained those people, they're making extra attention to that. And you're right, if I'm not in the mix, the extra attention, they're just going to treat it like anything else. But, you know, it's characterized as, well, you were threatening her. And I think for him to deny threatening her, that is, that this was a threat, I think is a mischaracterization. What he said about the property on the tape was true as to the risk that she faced. And undoubtedly, although we don't know for a fact, but undoubtedly, he did use his influence with the police officers as a retired police officer to have those folks look at it. He mentions that they got a couple of prostitutes out at one point. But I don't understand that is to saying that he lied about having that conversation. with her. The question was phrased, well, you were threatening her, right? You were trying to force her to sell you the property. I mean, it's not in so many words. And so I don't think that that's appropriate. I think, and those same arguments go to the abuse of trust. He just never held himself out to be an U.S. Marshal. He corrected. Well, you can't say he corrected, but if you look at when Katrina Robinson on cross-examination says he is a U.S. Marshal or he's working with the Marshals, I don't remember it from word to word, not 2 years ago. Let me stop you. Did he say he was a U.S. Marshal or working with U.S. Marshals? I don't remember. So it could have been working with the U.S. Marshals. It could have been. And that, of course, was exactly his role. And so I don't think that he lied about it, and I don't think he abused his trust about it. I'm going to run out of time before we can talk about the loss on selling a property for $165,000.
Unless my colleagues have questions, I think you actually are out of time,
counsel.
Seeing none, thank you. The case is submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.